Chapter 14. A Startling Claim. The College of Psychic Science was situated down a side street in South Kensington, not far from the Underground. A product of the wave of interest in spiritualism that had struck mid-Victorian England, it offered a programme of lectures on various aspects of the paranormal, as well as demonstrations of mediumship under controlled conditions. I had no special interest in either the lectures or the demonstrations, for though I knew from my own experience that things for which there was no scientific explanation did happen, and was willing to believe that not all mediums were frauds, for me such matters had no direct bearing on the living of the spiritual life. What interested me about the College of Psychic Science was the fact that its lecture room was for hire at a reasonable rate, and that the college itself was located in a part of London to which I was keen to extend the Sangha Association's activities. True, I was already giving a weekly lecture at the Hampstead Vihara and fortnightly lectures at Berg House and the Buddhist Society, besides occasional lectures elsewhere. But at that time I was possessed by a passion for spreading the Dharma through the medium of the spoken word. Socially and economically, South Kensington was a very different kind of place from Hampstead, and a series of lectures there might be expected to attract a correspondingly different kind of audience. Beginning in the middle of March, I therefore travelled every alternate Wednesday from Belsize Park down to South Kensington and to the rather gloomy premises of the College of Psychic Science. The lecture room, which was situated at the front of the building on the first floor, seated about 60 people, and thanks to its big windows was fairly well lighted. Entrance hall, staircase and first floor landing and passages were, on the contrary, all dimly lit, though not so dimly that one could not make out, through the gloom, the framed examples of spiritualist art with which the walls on either hand were entirely covered. An art of crepuscular colours in which mysterious red-robed figures floated through vast cathedral-like interiors. The atmosphere of the place was not exactly spooky, but one sensed that something out of the ordinary went on there. My first lecture on Buddhism and humanism was poorly attended, Morris having forgotten to advertise it, and the second, devoted to Buddhism and mental health, fared only a little better. But for the third in the series, we had a full house, the subject on this occasion being Buddhism and the Problem of Death. What had led me to speak on such a topic, I cannot say. Perhaps I thought it might attract some of the people who attended the college's own lectures. There certainly were a lot of unfamiliar faces in the audience that evening, as well as those of Anna Phillips, Bill Revel and Ruth, and the rest of the little contingent from the Vihara that manned the bookstall, tape-recorded my lecture, and stood at the door with the Dharma bowl at the end of the meeting. Death was not something about which I had thought very much. Awareness of the inevitability of death had played no part in my becoming a monk, any more than it had in my realisation that I was a Buddhist. I knew that I would die, but the knowledge did not go very deep, until the day I heard the young English monk Kantipalo, then known as Sujiva, speak on the subject at a training course I had organised for new Indian Buddhists in Pune. Kantipalo said nothing I had not heard or read many times before. I could have been giving the talk myself. But on this occasion, the familiar words took on a vital new meaning and sank deeply into my heart. I knew that I would die. That was 3 years ago. Kantipalo was now in Thailand, but we were still in touch, and perhaps it was a letter from him which, by reviving memories of that day, had led me to speak on Buddhism and the problem of death. I began by denying that the subject was a morbid one. Far from being morbid, thinking about the fact of death was realistic, even though people who liked to think of themselves as realistic tended to be unrealistic in this regard. To speak of death in euphemistic terms, to have gloomy funerals and to hide the dead body in a wooden box, this was what was really morbid. It was morbid because it represented a refusal to accept the fact of death. And it was this refusal, not death itself, that constituted the problem. The reason we refused to accept the fact of death was that we clung to self and saw death as signifying loss of selfhood. We therefore feared death. Indeed, so terrible to us did loss of selfhood appear that we were unable to contemplate even the bare idea of it. This suppressed or repressed fear of death was the cause of much psychological disturbance. We were unable to come to terms with life, were unable to live happily, because we had not faced the fact of death. Haunted, as it were, by a suppressed fear of death, we were like the man who sees a ghost but pretends it isn't there. The problem could be resolved, I declared, if we first learned to face the facts and the recollection of death practice, one of the group of 40 traditional Buddhist meditation exercises could help us do this. Having described the practice at length, I pointed out that if we bore the fact that we will die one day constantly in mind and oriented our lives accordingly, many things now regarded as important would become unimportant. Quarrels would cease, and funerals, instead of being gloomy, would be relatively cheerful affairs, as they were in the Buddhist countries of Asia. Besides teaching the recollection of death practice, Buddhism studied the phenomenon of death in detail, paying greater attention to the psychological and spiritual dimensions of the process than was usual in the West. According to Buddhism, death takes place in five stages. The physical senses withdraw from their respective objects so that the external world is no longer perceived. The breath ceases. Heat departs from the body. The dying person swoons. And finally, consciousness is completely dissociated from the physical organism. Buddhism also taught that at the time of death, various experiences of a hallucinatory nature could occur. One might see oneself performing past actions, whether skillful or unskillful, or see signs indicative of one's place of next rebirth. All this was common ground to the different forms of Buddhism, I said. But Tibetan Buddhism investigated the death process in greater detail than any other school. In particular, it investigated what happened in the bardo, or so-called intermediate state, the period between the ending of one life and the beginning of another. Having explained that in fact there were three bardos, I went on to describe each of them in turn, following the account given in the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead. I described how in what was termed the bardo of the moment of death, one is suddenly confronted by the pure white light of the void, the light of ultimate reality, and how, if one does not shrink back from it in terror, one is able to recognize it as one's own mind in its primordial state, and one achieves liberation from the cycle of repeated births and deaths. Such an achievement was within the reach only of those who, during their lifetime, had been advanced practitioners of meditation. Next, I described how in the bardo of glimpsing reality, those who had been unable to achieve liberation in the bardo at the moment of death are faced by a succession of glorious visions, visions of archetypal Buddhas and other divine beings, and how, if one has meditated on them during one's lifetime and neither shrinks from their dazzling radiance nor is attracted by the duller light proceeding from the corresponding sphere of mundane existence, one attains Buddhahood in the archetypal realm. Finally, I described how in the bardo of seeking rebirth, those who had neither achieved liberation nor attained Buddhahood see a vision of the five or six spheres of mundane existence, and how if they are attracted to the human sphere, as usually is the case, they see their future parents copulating, try to get between them, and fall into a swoon, whereupon there follows conception and eventually rebirth. While I was describing the three bardos, the audience was especially attentive, and there prevailed in the room an atmosphere the intensity of which relaxed only slightly when I went on to speak of the post-mortem rituals of Tibetan Buddhism and to draw attention to the correlation between the three bardos and the deep sleep, dream and waking states and the three kayas or bodies of Buddhahood. I concluded by saying that death was a problem only when it was ignored or seen outside of context. If life was understood, death was understood, and vice versa. Life and death were the two sides of the same coin. Once this was realized, there was no problem, but only a great opportunity for which we had to prepare ourselves now. After the lecture, which lasted nearly an hour and a half, several members of the audience came and spoke to me, as people often did on such occasions. The last person to come was a tall young man in a dark three-piece suit who had been sitting in the front row making notes and whom I had, I thought, seen once or twice before. "I just wanted to tell you," he said, "that I have seen the pure white light." Had almost anyone else made such a startling claim, I would have been inclined to think he was either crazy or a charlatan. But so unassuming was the young man's demeanour, and so frank and trustful his gaze, that it was impossible for me not to believe that he spoke the truth. What reply I made I do not remember. Probably I simply acknowledged his communication in a way that showed him I took it seriously. The following month, he was at the Vihara for my Sunday afternoon lecture on right livelihood, and I invited him to come and see me one evening. This he shortly afterwards did, and we had a long and interesting talk, lasting until nearly midnight, in the course of which he told me his entire history. "Quite an exceptional person," I commented in my diary. After my next lecture at the College of Psychic Science, which this time was on Buddhism and mysticism, he offered me a lift in his Volkswagen Caravan, Anna's little car not being available. Not wanting to trouble him unnecessarily and thinking that perhaps he could drop me at a convenient underground station, I asked him how far in the direction of the Vihara he was willing to drive. "I can drive you as far as you like," was the cheerful response. "Could you drive me to India?" I asked, the words springing unpremeditated to my lips. "Yes," he replied, his face lighting up, "I could." Thus began a friendship that was to have important consequences for the rest of my life, and through me, for the future of British Buddhism.